Hey, it's Ash Zane, and this is I Got Questions. Today, I talked to my father-in-law, Henry, about being the child of World War II survivors, growing up in Montreal, working his way up through the factories and textile industry, and how he got into the horse racing business. Enjoy. Hi, Henry.
Hi there.
You're my father-in-law, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Last I checked.
Still, yeah. Let's see after today how it goes. You were born in Montreal.
1951.
And tell me about your parents. Where were they born?
They're both born in Poland.
Okay.
My father in the mountains around Krakow. My mother more in the flatlands east of Warsaw in a place called Zeszów, if I say it right.
Do you know where they met?
They met during the war in the camps. I mean, both of them were taken as slave labor into Germany in 1939-40. My father was 16. My mother was 14, wow. 15. My mother's case, it was the whole family. My father's case was just him. He was taken.
And how long were they in the camps? And then, like, how long did it take to
through the entire war? They were there until 1945, and then they were in refugee camps from 45 to 49, and they came to Canada in 49.
And they met in the camps?
Met in camps.
The refugee camps.
They got married right after the war, 1945.
And do you know at all the story of, like, okay, they met, but how did they know, like, oh, we should get married?
People got married in those days because somebody could take care of you.
Okay.
Love was secondary if you wanted to take care of it. My father took care of them. So, like, if they needed food or some help with something, or there was a lot of black market stuff going on.
Sure.
Whatever they could do, it was providers that was the first thing. Love was the secondary thing.
So they probably meet and they think, like, we should probably partner up to survive this thing.
Yeah, I guess so. And then, you know, they kind of knew each other through the war on and off, and they kind of liked each other, but I don't know if love was possible in those days. It was with the things they went through.
Yeah.
You know, my parents said that at the end of the war, they used to have to sneak into the fields at night and eat rotten potatoes because there was no food. Because
right.
the Germans kept the food for themselves because there was no food
of
for them
course.
Either.
Yeah.
So the slave labor got whatever was left, which was nothing. So
right.
They had to survive. And, you know, you don't realize what they went through. Well, you realize later on that they lost all their youth. They went from, you know, from 15 to 25, 26 before they could actually start living. Because before that, it was all controlled.
And you start living after going through something so traumatic. It's not like us where we get ready. You go through school.
Yeah.
You have time to figure out what you want to do.
Exactly.
They're just nonstop. Were they forthcoming with stories about the war? Did you have to pull it out of them? Did it trickle out?
We had to pull it. It trickled. Yeah. We had to pull it. It's not easy. My father still doesn't. I mean, one of these days, maybe you should interview my dad.
He is on my list.
Yeah. He'd probably tell you stuff that he didn't tell us, because, you know, it's funny.
Do you remember, was there an age when you realized, like, oh, my parents went through, like, the war, like, when you found out about World War II in school, did you already know your parents lived through it? Or was this just something that was just common knowledge around the house, like, hey, we came from war?
Yeah, it was common knowledge. When? I guess.
There wasn't a moment where you thought, holy shit, they went through.
Not really. Yeah, it's just kind of like, they tell some stories. When they were drunk, they would sing what stories and they'd tell you stuff. Because when they came to this country, they partied for a few years after they came, because they didn't party at all throughout the war. So here they came to Canada. Booze was cheap. Food was cheap. So they worked hard and drank.
let's talk about when they came to Canada. Yeah. I think I've asked your dad, but I don't really remember. Why Canada and why Montreal? Do you know how that worked?
It worked on a sponsorship program. Basically, it was a throw of the dice. There were certain countries that were accepting people.
Right.
US, Canada, South America, Australia, England even. And it was somebody was looking to sponsor. They needed my parents to be housekeepers for the house. So there was a rich couple in Montreal, and they got on a boat. They landed in Halifax, and
right.
And I think the government gave them $2 and say, okay, here's your ticket to go to Montreal, and that was it. And you live on your own. So they
And they didn't speak English at all?
Not a word.
Not French?
German, Polish.
And that's somehow it. From Halifax, they found their way to Montreal, and they found this guy who basically sponsored them to be...
Sponsored them, yeah. So my mother was the maid, and my father was the butler. Or my father was for a year, my mother was for 2 or 3 years. And I was born in their house, actually. So I was born with them. And they were family friends for years, for 4 years.
Basically, they came here, they started to work, then you came along.
I came along in their house. I was born in Westmount, Quebec, in a small mansion.
And you have a brother who's younger than you?
Correct.
Okay. And he wasn't born in that house?
No.
Okay. It's more questions for your dad, but do you know if there's like any training, or he just had to like look or pick it up as he went along?
They showed him how to serve, how to put the plates down, which side to feed them.
Wow.
My parents always thought it was great because they learned the way to do things.
Like assimilate?
Well, yeah, like how to serve, how to treat, how to talk, how to be polite.
Right.
All the social graces they kind of learned from these people. So in a way, it was a good thing. And my dad also loved Germany because the Germans were very organized, very systemized, very disciplined.
Right.
And he liked the idea of how that worked compared to Poland, which was very peasants.
Right.
It wasn't a life he liked. He liked the regiment of being in Germany, and he kept that with him for all his life.
Now that you put it that way, I can see it.
Yeah.
He's very simple, but he has a system, and he follows that. Sick,
exactly.
Not sick. He does his things that he needs to do. Exercises. And, writes everything
what's
down.
What's right is right.
Yeah, that's right.
The way to do it is the way to do it. And
what are your memories of Montreal growing up? What's like the first memory you have?
I remember the house in Westmount. Believe it or not, I remember I think I was there for only a couple of years, but I remember they had a large window. They lived on the crest of Mount Royal. And from their back window, they had bank windows, and you could see the entire city right from there. So I remember sitting and looking out at Montreal. So that was really cool. I remember Mr. and Mrs. Lank. I remember them well. And even though we spent time with them after, but I mean, up to their death. I remember that. They died. He died in 1980. She died in 1990 or so.
Okay, not that long ago.
Not that long ago, no.
No.
They lived a good long life, yeah.
And you guys live with them at that house?
Lived in the house for 2 or 3 years, then we moved with them, but then my father did odd jobs. I mean, the man wanted to put me through school.
Right.
He offered to start my dad in business. He did all kinds of things, and my father never was afraid to, or I'm not sure he was... He said, I'm not important enough or I'm not good enough to do it. He didn't have the language skills yet. So he never did. And he found a job working in a paint factory, which he worked there for like 30 years after. Then he took my mom. But he always did odd jobs for them. So they were like our friends.
Got it.
We saw each other for Christmas every year. My mother made cookies for them. They just loved us. And they just...
That was very sweet.
Well, and they said, as far as my parents were concerned, he says, you know, they used to have a lot of people working for them over the years. And they said, my parents were the most honest people they ever met. They never had to worry about leaving their money anywhere or anything like that. My parents were always the most down to earth, honest people they've ever met. And they were like family to us for years.
So I never got a chance to meet your mother, but personality wise, how similar was she to your father?
Completely different. My mother is very, very nurturing, almost over nurturing. My father worked.
Right.
he worked a lot. He worked 2, 3, 4 jobs. My father was the disciplinarian. My mom was the heart of the, you know, the soul of, you know, she had her ways. She had her ways of cajoling or manipulating, like all moms do.
Yeah.
But she was a mom, and she was the, because of the war, they basically, my mother over nurtured. Everything was scary. The world was going to come down upon them all the time. So
yeah, of course.
So like the October crisis for them was like Germany again.
Here we go.
She lived in fear most of her life. A lot of my father, no, not so much. But my mother, yes.
But that doesn't seem to have rubbed off on you. I don't see you really worry about much.
My life is gone. I've gone through a lot of phases in my life. No, war babies are war babies. And they call us war babies. People that were born like right after the war. From people that went through the war, like my parents, we always felt a little bit inferior, or like we were the immigrants, like the we always had an inferiority complex built into us. it was always a little bit of fear also. Right. You know, like in other words, you know, it took me a lot to push myself to go to do things early in my life. There were other things that stopped me, but that was a big part of it.
How was your childhood in Montreal? Was there a fun childhood? You've told me some like adventure stories, but overall, if you were to sum it up, thumbs up.
It was fun. And yeah. It was fun. The only problem I had is that I stuttered terribly, and that really affected my life. A big part of my, like from grade one or grade two on. What was great about it, my father, we used to spend all summer long in country. So we would live in the city, go to school,
yeah.
And the whole summer long, we started off going to a farm, a Polish farm up there.
Yeah.
And we would go chasing, we'd be out in the bush all day long. And we had a ball. And that was all summer long.
Like all 2 months?
Hmm? The whole 2 months.
Oh, that's
June,
amazing.
July, August. It was the whole 3 months.
Amazing.
And the mothers would get together and we have a great, great kind of a time.
Is the Polish community really connected there and tight?
Not really. There was a small Polish community there, and they knew each other reasonably well. And the people in the farm, there was like four or five families that lived on, that went to the farm, helped the farmer. So I was helping the farmer hay and do all that kind of stuff.
During the school year, what did you guys do for fun? Is it just running up and down the neighborhood?
Whatever? Yeah, parks. Yeah, in those days, you could go out to play in the park and play football, baseball, all that kind of stuff.
Can you remember a time when you and your friends got into trouble doing something you shouldn't have?
Oh yeah, we went into the picking crab apples from a neighbor had the big crab apple tree. We used to go and steal them. We used to go onto his garage and steal them. The old man come out, a little Italian man come and chase him, that kind of stuff.
What about school? What was school like?
Because we lived in Quebec, so there weren't that many English schools.
Okay,
we had to kind of walk to school, which is quite a good distance. In those days, the French and English were kind of tough with each other. And we were considered English, even though we were not English, but we were
not
considering
French.
Because we used to go to English. We're not French.
Right.
And so the French used to beat the hell out of us wherever they could. So we used to have to walk by the French schools. And they sit there and wait for you. They literally wait in gangs for you. So you either walked in a group, or if you walked alone, you had rocks. I used to carry rocks in my pocket. Those were like logs, really hard, so sharp rocks to use for
like gravel
and stuff, yeah, because they come at you, you throw it at your belt at them, because they would beat the hell out of you.
This is grade school.
Wow. Grade school, grade 3, grade 4, grade 5. The Quebec thing is, you know, people said it was very real for young people. It was very real. Maybe the older people were more refined at it, but the young people were taught to hate us.
What was the makeup of your class in an all-English school?
A lot of Italians, because it was in an Italian area where I was most of my time, a lot of Italians, then mixture Polish, Ukrainian, no colored people ever.
Yeah.
No, those days that wasn't in the area. There was no whatever. Italians were the big part. So I used to know how to swear in Italian better than anybody.
Do you still know how to swear in Italian? Like if we get you in traffic?
Yes.
Okay.
You know,
And what were...
Italian and Yiddish and Jewish and...
Oh, did the Jewish kids go there too?
No, didn't go there. But I used to work with a lot of Jewish people, and I used to go to Polish school too, and that was
like on weekends,
on Saturdays.
Okay,
to learn Polish, which I hated, but kind of a Jewish community there. I don't know. We used to have
like culturally Jewish,
Yeah, with the hats and the.
And what were the teachers like in the
English? Started off with nuns.
Okay.
Grade one, then grade two, they were all pretty good. I mean, they were tough. I mean, they were tough.
Were they like all clergy?
No.
Okay.
No. I had sisters in grade one. I had brothers in high school, all through high school. Irish Christian brothers. They were tough.
And it's all boys school all the way through?
All boys. All boys right through high school. Yep.
Yeah.
They were all segregated right through until...
What kind of student were you?
Average. My biggest thing is I stuttered. So that to me was a real trauma. That was my introverted period, which is a good part of my life. Like I couldn't do this right now, I'm doing now today with you.
Yeah.
I wouldn't be able to sit with you and talk.
And have a conversation.
Ever
since I've known you, you've been able to speak like this. But I remember Laura telling me, no, he couldn't for the longest time.
Yeah.
But you still had a group of friends growing up, right?
Yeah. I had some, we were the nerds.
Okay.
I wasn't the in the in crowd because I stuttered.
Mm-hmm.
So we tended to my friends tended to be the outsiders, like you know, big fat Ukrainian kid was Paul, was one of my, bring another one, Emmanuel, short little Italian kid were the ones.
Have you stayed in touch with any of these people or talked to
Paul? He's on Facebook. So I talk to him occasionally. We're supposed to have a long conversation soon. I haven't talked to him for 20 years, well, more than that, 30, 40 years.
You met Terry, your wife, in high school? Or after?
After. I was at a Polish dance. My parents used to take me to these Polish dances where... Right. I guess they took us just to meet girls, I guess, or meet people and more or whatever, and because they wanted you to integrate with other Polish girls, even though I didn't really do that, but somehow, even though that was my stuttering days,
right?
Somehow I asked her to dance. I don't know why, but I did once, and then she went to another dance, met a couple of times, then. Her parents lived in the country house close to where my parents had a country house, the same area where the farm was. So I kind of would drop in and say hi once in a while, and it just kind of
just grew
from there. Yeah.
So your parents knew her parents before?
Not very well. Okay. No, I met them. We met them at a dance, but they kind of knew each other passing, but nothing.
So it wasn't like prearranged.
Nothing.
You just got to know each other afterwards.
Yeah.
So after
she took pity on me, I guess. And
well, if she allows it, I want to get her side of this one day.
Yeah, okay, I'm sure she will.
But yeah, she's even more hesitant than you were.
Probably.
After high school, what did you do for school?
University.
Mm-hmm. Which one?
Because we had to go. Those days were called Sir George Williams University. That was part of Loyola.
And what did you study?
Biochemistry. Believe it or not, don't ask me why I did that, but I did.
So I heard that you also, or maybe your parents wanted you to join the clergy.
My mother did.
Okay.
Mother really, really wanted me to.
Did you have any interest in it at all?
No.
No. But was it hard breaking that to her? Or she just understood because she knew
you? I didn't. Just no feeling for it. But my mother really wanted it to be.
Yeah.
It would be like every Polish mother wanted to have a priest as one of her kids. Whoa, that would be a real big thing for them.
Yeah.
It'd be a real status thing.
So you took biochemistry.
Don't ask me. I hated it.
Yeah.
But first of all, look, I, you finished high school and you grade 11 and you went right away, right into university. 11. And it was a three year program.
So you're like 16.
16, 17.
Oh, that's crazy.
Young. I was too young. I was stupid. I was also very afraid of everything because I was afraid of my shadow. I couldn't talk. I couldn't talk to anywhere.
Right.
So I was very introverted, very scared. Like you said, I wasn't afraid. I was very afraid of everything. And I failed at everything. University is more as much social as it is education.
Right.
And I think the biggest part of your education is the social part, is the getting to know people and helping each other. And it's not just sheer learning.
Going to class,
class and stuff.
Yeah.
So
I remember when I went to university, your advice to me was, don't worry about the books, just survive it.
Yeah.
If you can get through 4 years, you've learned more than you think you've learned.
Yeah. That's true. And I didn't survive it. I took a minor in computer science, which is what I kind of like started going toward mentally.
Right.
I kind of liked that idea, the discipline, but biochemistry was just a complete. You had to be something. Had to be an engineer or a scientist. That's what.
Right.
That's what Polish people thought. Business? No, you didn't go into business. You would not do that kind of stuff. Management? All that? Nah.
Is what you've ended up doing.
Most of my life was either some kind of managing or consulting or computer related or variation. I changed my career about 7 or 8 times.
What was your first job?
First job was working in my father's plant in going. I paid my way through college. So when I started university, I would go to work every summer and pay for it. In those days, you could make enough money in the summer to pay for your education because tuition was like $1,600.
What did you do at the plant?
I worked in the paint factory. I worked in shipping, receiving, and I worked in a watchman for a while. Odd jobs all in the place. Students would hire there. I worked hard. Everybody liked me because I was a very hard worker.
What did you ever interact with your dad at work, or you guys were far away in the plant?
My dad. Everybody knew I was the dad, and he was the kind of a guy that could fix anything.
Right.
Worked his way up from the live-at room, picking up garbage, to becoming an electrician mechanic.
Right.
That was pretty cool. for a man.
I remember.
I was very proud of him for that because he was like the king. You know, if there's a problem at work, call my dad. He was the guy. Anything, fix anything. You know?
After I met him the first few times, I think that's when I left the government. Mm-hmm. Because he started to tell me all the things he's done.
Yeah.
I'm like, what am I doing? 3 years, like my best years. Why am I just sitting in the cubicle?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Just pay my dues for a while.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He went to school on his own and he learned everything on his own and he could take anything apart, put it back together again. Amazing. I was really surprised.
So you did odd jobs in the summer. Then you leave school. What do you do from there?
I worked at Electrolux. I was a guy who made vacuum cleaners. I did a molding cutter. I made molds of the body of the vacuum cleaner for about my first real job. Really good paying. It was like union wages, and I was paying big bucks.
Right.
Then I was offered. Then a good guy offered me a job. Somebody said, "There's a job, assistant to the warehouse manager of a textile company just down the street from us. Nothing pay." So I went from like, you know,
good factory union job,
$200 a week to like $60, like it was like nothing.
Why did you switch?
I didn't learn. I couldn't learn anything. I mean, I was basically sitting there, and I knew, after you learn the job in 12 minutes, how to make the thing, you got to keep it at that level, and you got to trim it, and you got to put it back in the box. And it's like, you're part of a machine. It's all you are.
And then you just repeat all day until you're done your career.
Yeah. You repeat, you go home, you do the same thing. You've done so many. You did 300 bodies today. Wow.
Yeah.
I'd be happy. And so this was a job where I basically was helping him manage. So I learned the idea of being responsible. So what was strange about it is I still stuttered. I still couldn't, I couldn't talk very well to anybody, but I always seemed to lean toward being in charge.
Right. Something.
For some reason, people always trusted me and said, Henry could do this. So I went from assistant to manager to another department. I ran an entire warehouse and all the offices. So at 23, 24, I had 40 people working for me.
Did you have a mentor at all?
Yeah, the warehouse guy was named Ben, a Danish guy. He taught me about how to manage, how to do it calmly, how to talk to people, how to get people to work for you and all that kind of stuff. Yeah, it's just basic common sense. Managing is common sense and listening more than anything else. Because I stuttered, what I had to really develop is my listening skills. Or my empathy skills. So I could sit there and talk and understand what people were bothering them. And people liked me and would do work for me because it was me.
Yeah.
So I had responsibility very young. And I just kept going. I mean, on and on, as most of my career was that.
Do you remember, besides the stuttering, what the hardest part of that job was?
Job I loved. I never had a hard time. I could talk one-on-one with almost any... Well, more or less all around, but I could get my way with what I wanted,
right,
or manipulate or plan my way through it. Because also the computer skills, the computers started coming in then, and my computer skills, the logic part about how to do things all came into form. So when I saw a job, I saw the whole picture of how to do it, not just the individual person, what he has to do,
right,
how it interrelates and how you build it and how you make it, how to use the forms and how to put a process into anything. I could see that visually, just like I could calculate visually in my head,
right?
Calculate numbers. It's something I could just see. So that was the hard part. Was always anything to do with lots of people. Answering a phone for me was hell.
Right.
You picture it. I couldn't answer a phone easily because I would stutter.
Yeah.
It comes out when I'm stressed, I'm tired, whatever. So.
And with a phone call, it's a surprise.
I never know who's on the other side. I would, and then I would say, who's speaking? I had my name, and it was just, and people are cruel. Even anywhere they're cruel. People laugh at you somewhere in the back. So, first of all, because I stuttered, I had to work harder than anybody,
right?
Management or not, I had to be better and work harder than anybody. I had to outwork anybody, which I did. I basically could do any job. In other words, I could not only manage them, I could say, okay, now I'll show you how to work because I'll work better than you. Because I just did.
Lead by example, basically.
By example is a biggie. It was a biggie.
What did the textile company make?
Fabric. All they made was a different kind of fabric. They had mills all over Ontario, Quebec.
And how long did you work there?
Guessing now 2 or 3 years, 4 years. Then I worked in another division, which I took over, and I built a division
So to summarize so far your careers, it's like the traditional thing of like you work from the ground up, you did the odd jobs, then you had a line on the factory, then you started managing people who did that job, now you're managing the managers, and you're just working your way up.
Yeah, and basically it was always like my dad.
Yeah.
If you think about it, when something's wrong, call my dad. So yeah. whenever I took over anything, so when I took over the drapery department, for instance, it was a disaster. It was a complete disaster. They said, send in Henry.
Yeah.
And they didn't give me a title. I just said, send in Henry to fix it. Mm-hmm. I fixed it. But it worked like 6 months, like 7 days a week.
Yeah.
I would call up Manpower and say, send me 10 guys.
Yeah.
If they survive the day with me, I'll keep one or two, maybe. So I would get 10,
right.
Keep two, and slowly build my staff up to 35.
Just the cream of the crop.
Cream of the crop, because you're gone. Go. Because I couldn't, I didn't have time.
Right.
And we cleaned up everything. We reorganized everything. We caught up on all the shipments. Did it all.
Yeah.
And I built it all, and I had it all in my head. I basically said, this is how it's going to work. And it worked. It came about. So whatever I visualized, it's my strength, is like to visualize something and say how it's going to work.
And you have a very mathematical mind as well.
Yeah.
Like you break up things into their individual components, like you said.
Yeah. Then I put them together. In the right order.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. Like your dad, taking things apart and putting them together.
Yeah, in a way, it's funny, but you're thinking about it now, but you're right. It's kind of a way of putting it together.
When and why did you leave that job?
I was offered another job at Le Chateau.
Okay.
That was a retailer. They wanted me to take over the warehouse. The warehouse and the distribution area.
Well. Do you know how they found out about you? Because back then, there's no LinkedIn. It's just word of mouth.
It was word of mouth. They called me up.
Right.
And they said, Henry, you want to take over this position? Somewhere between there was a holiday luggage, ran the warehouse part of it for a year or so, and left.
Why didn't you like the luggage place?
Because they didn't listen to what I wanted to do.
Got it.
The luggage business in those days was so profitable. They would ship it in here and they would send it to the retailers.
So they just distributed?
They just distributed.
Okay.
But they weren't very efficient at it. So I said, listen, you don't have to stuff all this stuff in advance.
Right.
You don't have to have all this space and the kind of stuff. Pre-do all this shit, make all the space and do it. They just didn't want to do it because they made so much money.
Yeah, why?
Because they,
yeah.
they were making, put it this way, they bought a big carry-on for $20. They sell it for $100 and $200. Like Crazy. it was obscene. Yeah. And then they go sell it for $400. But I told them, guys, if you don't think the retailers will go and find those where you're making it themselves, they will.
Yeah.
They'll bypass you if they can.
Cut out the middleman.
And cut out the middleman if they can, if they're big enough. And surely they did. And so they went bankrupt. I mean, but I told them it's going to happen. But and they also, I didn't like the idea that they owned the buyers. So they had the Bay, the Sears, Simpsons. The buyers from those companies would get gifts like
Jeep. Oh, I see.
A Jeep.
A car?
A car. For their wives, or
it's a lot TV of money.
A lot of money was a lot. It was huge. The profit was huge.
Yeah.
The stores found out about this. All those buyers went out too. So a lot of things happened to the industry.
Got it.
Now you could go now to Costco and buy a luggage set for $200.
And the whole set.
They used to be $200 was the smallest piece for $200.
Right.
In those days.
But, then you go to Le Chateau.
Le Chateau was, there's something missing, something's in the missing, but in the middle, but Le Chateau, and I went from 200, they had 100 and something staff in the distribution center, brought it down to 27 people doing the same work base. So 160 stores doing, we did it with 27 people.
So if I worked in those warehouses and you got a job there, I'd work on my resume, because if you're going to cut 120 people.
Well, I cut, it was 100 people working there.
Right.
I cut 80, yeah. I cut about 90. I probably cut all 100. There weren't many that left after a while. And I didn't fire anybody. No, I would fire one or two. I fire one or two relatively quickly just so people could get the message, but I didn't fire ever. People would quit.
Just people, because it's too tough?
Just to do the work. Yeah, just do the work. Just, you know, I'm not pushing or anything. I'm not being mean or anything. I never was.
Right.
I never yelled. I never screamed at anybody. Just do the work. And if he didn't do the work, I would just measure what you're doing.
You just expose them.
Yeah. If you had five people doing something, five of them, wherever, and I would say, okay, why is this guy doing three times what you're doing?
Right.
I'm not saying do three times, but do a little bit more.
Yeah.
After a while, being persistent at it, they just walk out the door. Then they asked me to take over the sewing department because they used to manufacture 55% of whatever they sold, they made.
In Montreal?
In Montreal.
Yeah.
So they made it in the Bose and Shoppers. So we did everything from, we'd cut and grade and make all the patterns and make all the designs. So I was responsible for all that. And we would cut the patterns, we would send out to be sold, and we control it all and send out. So I did all that too. That was another millions of dollars.
Was this work stressful? Were you working like 7 days a week, just all day working?
I was learning to take it easy a little bit more, but I worked hard.
Yeah.
I worked hard. I didn't, it was hard work.
Because, and you didn't have kids at this point?
Yeah, I started getting kids at that point. Yeah, Laura was born at that point, and then, yeah.
And this is while you were at Le Chateau?
Yeah. Yeah, dude, I was working hard, and that's why I didn't spend enough time with the girls as I wanted to. You know, we tried, but
not like your dad though. Like your dad worked all the time.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, but still, it was hard. The first person to bring in CAD/CAM into the business, technology into the pattern making and all that stuff. So
yeah,
cutting was all computerized. Everything was. We knew what was going to be lost and stuff.
Where did you go from Le Chateau? Like, when did you leave the manufacturing distribution business?
I went. I started my own business. I was playing around with manufacturing myself. Number one. Number two is, it wasn't Chateau. Started going bad when, and I hope this never gets into the public. they were crooked.
I was just going to ask you, being in Montreal and any of these places you worked, did you have any encounters with the mafia and the mob?
Not the mafia, but they were crooked themselves. So bottom line is they would make things, and even though we were a public company,
yeah,
they would charge themselves more, but keep the money in the back.
Oh, I see.
And then sell it out. So I knew what every garment would come in, and all of a sudden, if a garment came in at, let's say they brought in a t-shirt at $30. I could make this for $5 here.
Right.
What are you doing? And no auditor could ever check that this is a $30. I mean, who knows if this is a $30 t-shirt?
Right.
So they would go 30, they would sell it at cost, or they would, or sell it below cost. They didn't know, they would lose money. It didn't matter, but the money was sitting somewhere else.
They're just cooking books.
I found out about this.
Okay.
And they didn't like this. So I had to leave. It became very, very stressful.
Yeah.
That I made the mistake of going to president myself and saying, what's going on? Everything started going sour from that point on because I kind of stupid enough. I was naive enough to not realize that this was going on.
To the top.
Right to the top.
Yeah.
I thought it was somewhere down right to the top. It was like, yeah. Was so this? Like you can make money in fabric, in the textile business, you can make so much money. It's obscene.
Is it because it just switches hands so often, or there's no auditing?
There is no auditing. I mean, like you don't know what something, you don't know if you make a pair of shorts, what it costs. I mean,
yeah.
So I had to go out on my own.
Did you see any of this at the other places? Or was this the worst you saw?
Well, the other places was like the luggage was, you know, paying off people. Like, right. That was open. Like, not open. It was, you saw it.
Yeah.
All the European Jewish type, there was always some kind of game going on. Always something. That's what the textile business is. You know, like...
Is it a survival thing or it's just a personality?
I think it's a survival thing. Part of it is survival.
Because I think about those people, they probably came from war too, and you can't just turn off that part of you.
You can't. And you know, thinking being older, maybe I would have handled a lot of those things differently today. I was very naive. I was very like, you know, I was stupid. I mean, very naive.
You were still young though.
Yeah, I was very young. So pretty young. So yeah, then I went into business on my own for a while to make jeans. Mm-hmm. I was a jean manufacturer or designer manufacturer. Had a Jewish partner and a Chinese partner, and we started off, we did very well until something happens. We had a deal where we were going to have Chinese goods come in on terms. In other words, we could make clothes, bring them in, and only pay for it when they're sold.
Which was
just because the Chinese partner had family in China, and he was going to make the stuff for us and on terms, which is the big thing. Because I mean, if you have to wait 4 weeks to get the fabric, and then 4 weeks to 6 weeks to sew, and then 4 weeks on the water, and then shipping, and get paid in 90 days, the cash flow is extremely hard to get to get the money flowing, because that's what it is, all cash flow. My Chinese partner, suddenly his entire family disappeared in China. We did it for a couple of times, and then China just disappeared. So they were either using slave labor or something. They weren't doing it legally in China. Right. Disappeared. He would go to China regularly and do this, but his family suddenly just...
So just one day you don't hear from them?
They don't hear from them. They're gone. They're just gone. They're all thrown into jail.
So did you just have to liquidate everything?
Basically what we did is we tried to do it on our own for a while.
Okay.
So we'd buy fabric here and we sew it here. Then we became too successful. Couldn't take orders because we couldn't get the cash flow. We couldn't turn it fast enough because, again, 4 weeks for the, even though it's, you still got to order some fabric.
Right.
If you're lucky, it's in stock, but if it's not, you got to make it. You might wait 2, 3, 4 weeks to get the fabric. Then you got to sew it 2, 3, 4 weeks. And then it's still the same problem. You got to sell it to a retailer.
Right.
Some will pay in 30 days. Some will pay in 60. Some will pay in 90, whatever. And I needed $1 million to get to keep the flow going.
You can't line up money coming in and having to pay. It never works out that way. Someone's going to be late and it's going to screw up that whole chain, right? So correct. You need a float.
Yeah. And the banks wouldn't loan us money because we're new. And the banks, wanted your house, your 3 children and right. whatever, your future children and all that in those days. Because we're talking about...
80s now?
Yeah, 80s. The bad times. It wasn't great. I mean, that kind of stuff. So, yeah, we liquidated after a while. And then it started coming in Quebec, where the problem was in Quebec was not who you are, what you are. It's what language you speak, what your name is. And these jobs or doing work or consulting really started coming down to that. And this is, now we're talking about this, 90s. Yeah, 90s. It was 92, so 91, 92.
Early 90s, right?
Yeah, whatever. So,
just outward prejudice. You're not French.
You're not French. And even though I spoke a little bit, but nothing. You could live in Quebec in those days without speaking a word.
Especially Montreal.
Live in Montreal.
Yeah. So your big career change kind of lines up with moving out of Montreal?
Yeah.
Or were you doing that before you moved?
No, I was, moving out of Montreal, I was doing that when I was there, but then...
When we say that, what is it that you were doing? Once you finished the jeans?
Jean stuff, yeah, then I was looking for opportunities.
Okay.
I said, we're gonna get out of this province. I said, one day I looked up and I said to my wife, I says, I can't take it here anymore, I just can't.
Yeah.
I can't, it's driving me crazy.
Just too many closed doors
and the politics? Yeah, too many closed doors, and I said, what are we gonna leave our girls? What are they gonna be out with? Even though Laura was starting to go to, getting immersion, starting to touch on it a little bit. And that probably did her good, but I just didn't want them stuck in this kind of, it was pretty bad.
Were you the first of your family to leave Quebec?
No, my brother left Quebec way. He was in Ottawa already.
Oh, okay.
For lots of years. So I was saying, I'm going to think about going.
Yeah.
I'll start off in Ottawa and I'll go further down if I have to. So my brother, like you said, he left already. He was in the insurance business for lots of years. And I said, I wasn't thinking of working with him, but I said, I'm looking for opportunities here. I might consult. I might look for a job. I don't know what. But I know nobody from Ottawa is going to call me in Montreal. Right. So I got to kind of reside here. Residing here means you give me a phone somewhere in the corner. I don't need anything else. Just give me a phone in the corner. And I'll be here 3 days a week or whatever, as I need it and whatever. And I'll see. Yeah.
So you still lived in Montreal and you would come work here.
Yeah.
I see.
So I'm there in his business watching stuff going on. And I'm saying, oh my God, you're running a business, but you're not running a business.
You see optimization everywhere.
Everywhere. Not growing, it has no potential to grow, and you're basically just creating work for yourself. That's all it is. You're basically living paycheck to paycheck. And I said, let me look at your business. So I said, let me run it for a while. So I did everything.
For you, was it, let me get in there, see what I can contribute and just go from there? Or did you have a plan, like, I'm going to do this for a year and then do something
else? Well, I didn't. I just kind of went there and I just kind of got thralled in it. So we did about 9 years of that crap. So it was a lot of, and I also consulted on the side.
Okay.
I did some work for their clients. One of them was going bankrupt and helped him get out of that trouble and a bunch of other stuff. A lot of work, computers, servers. We were the first to have a website. We were the first to have email. We're talking about the 90s, 95, 96, 97. But during that time, I stopped stuttering.
Yeah. So I don't know the story behind this. Did you go to
I went. I went to. I went. I said, I went. I was 45 years old, right? 45. I remember the exact 45.
Yeah.
I hit my 45th birthday, and I said, this is enough of this. I can't take this anymore. I don't want to stutter anymore.
I completely forgot. This whole time, you still have this problem.
Oh, yeah. 45, I said, enough. So I went and looked up Dale Carnegie.
Okay.
I took a Dale Carnegie course. So
what is Dale Carnegie?
Dale Carnegie is business and how to make talk and how to handle business. And,
okay.
But a lot of it is speeches and talking to groups. A lot of it is that part of it. So what I wanted it for, it's like Toastmasters, but more business oriented.
Like the soft skills in business?
Yeah.
Okay.
You know, like, you know, how to keep in touch, how to win friends and influence people.
Understood.
That kind of stuff. Stuff that you're learning too, right?
Like, a little
right
bit, now, yeah.
If you think about that kind of stuff. Their principles are true today, like they were back. Dale Carnegie was the first Robbins, Anthony Robbins. Dale Carnegie was back in the 30s. That goes back that far. So I took the course and I continued on as a mentor for another 2 years after that. All through that, you're forced to talk every time you go. Every week, you got to go into a group of 30 people and you're talking over and over and over again. The fear of all that just kind of left me. Even though I'll still stutter, but I don't care anymore.
Right.
If I do, I don't care. I could talk to 100 people today.
Yeah,
I could go
I've
in.
Seen it.
And now people say, Henry, you were quiet for 45, 50 years. Now we can't keep your mouth. You can't keep you shut.
You're so catching up?
I'm catching up.
That's I forgot to ask you one more job you had in Montreal, the horse racing.
Oh,
you have to tell me how you got into it.
That's an interesting story. Well, yeah, I had a fellow who was working for us. His name was George.
Where were you working at this time?
I was working at Chateau.
Okay.
And he was a guy I hired to take care of quality control. He was a real character. And I think he always had money, driving around a Cadillac.
Okay.
And he says, I want this job because I meet people and I look for it. He was a wheeler dealer and all kinds
Got
of
it.
Stuff. Always was. Very, very brilliant guy. I mean, he says, I make money in all kinds of ways. He says, why don't I take you to the horses one day? And I says, but why? I don't know. He says, just come up. We'll go up to the lounge. Like, we'll eat something. We'll watch whatever. He gave me, he said, here's $100. I'll bet for you. $100.
You've never been to horse racing?
Never been to horse racing before. Okay. Never did anything. Whatever. So I just watched him. This guy, he bet. And I came out with $1,000. He won $1,000 on that $100.
Right.
One night. I was talking about, holy shit. What's going on here? And he just knew how to bet. He just knew what the racing was. He was involved in the trainers. He knew what the crusty side of the business is.
Got it.
A lot of it is fixed, but not completely fixed, but fixed enough. If you know what you're looking for, you know
enough to predict.
To predict enough. I started going like one day a week, and then we go 2 days a week. Then we went 3 or 4 days a week, 5 days, and I'd never lose.
He was consistent the whole time.
He would bet, and I would. I always come out money. Then he started saying, Henry, this time you're going to bet. I'll show you how to bet. He started talking to me how to bet, how to watch the horses coming in and seeing how they are. And all it was was a lot of the jockeys were betting themselves, but not personally. They would always have somebody else. They would always bet somebody else betting. So they would hold back horses waiting for the right odds, because the horse odds will change if they kept losing some. But they'll hold back a horse for certain races, and then they know, okay, my horse is strong.
Right.
This is the day. He's going to go.
Cash in.
And you could almost predict the timing of it. But then he also taught me that you never, never bet to win. You always bet place or show or place, second or third.
Okay.
You don't bet to win unless you're 100% sure. He says, I'll bet to win because I know some things. So you don't. You bet place or show. So, and you bet big. So you don't bet $5.
Right.
You bet $200, $100.
On second or third.
Second, because the odds will be big, but it doesn't matter. You'll win $50 or $60 per race. And then every once in a while, he also bet the trifectas, where you're betting three horses, 1, 2, 3.
Okay.
But you bet every combination of 1, 2, 3. And that the winnings in that could be $3,000. He would win consistently, $5,000 to $10,000 a night. Every night, he would win like that kind of money. I would win $1,000. You know, you go there 6 times in a week, you're winning $6,000. That's a lot of money.
Yeah.
Tax-free. Because no taxes.
Because it's like lottery?
It's lottery.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a winner. It's winning. So we ended up, from our winnings, we bought horses, cheap horses, whatever. Once you got horses, then you got into the trainers who you hired to take care of the horses, who would give you information about what's going on in the horses, and you get better. It's all fixed. It's all literally the poor schmucks who go there and bet it every day are you losers. It's the guy, the inside guys that are making all the money.
So you guys bought this stuff not because if your horse wins, you make money.
Didn't care.
You are gaining information by doing it.
Didn't care. If you won, it was great. You go up to the, it's a great feeling to go up to the winning circle right. when they pay out the horse because you're there taking pictures of. It's a great feeling, but it didn't matter.
And how does the story end?
The story ended, why don't we open up a few places to sew? So we were actually sewing garments for contracting. We got some guys
who won. The money from the winnings.
We got a little bit there involved in that and there, whatever. But then he started off, this guy is brilliant. He started a cartel of horses. So he got partners to buy horses. And it was a cartel of horses. So now it's like 10 guys who own horses.
And they're all
now,
feeding
we owned like 10, 12 horses, like wow. the cartel.
Right.
Which I was part of, right? I was like the secretary or whatever. He was president. Sure. And then this bugger, he took off. He took $60,000 out of the bank account and he left. He just disappeared.
Right.
And then he went to the bank. It was supposed to be two signatures and a check. He signed my signature and he just took off. Went to the police. The whole story. Police said, we got boatloads of files and these kind of stuff.
Yeah.
We'll get to it maybe 3 years if you want to. I had to dismantle. I had to sell all the horses. Wow. I had to run the whole business for about 6 months until I didn't want to sell it, throw everything away. I closed it all down, made everybody back, got everybody got paid back, and we did it. But it was hell for
how
stressful.
How long did you do that?
The horse thing?
Yeah.
Maybe a year and a half.
Okay.
Maybe, yeah. It wasn't that long, but it was very lucrative. I mean, I made a lot of money. I mean, honestly, but...
But like high stress at the end of it.
Well, at the end, it was very high stress.
Yeah.
I didn't have any stress while I was sitting there making $1,000 just for sitting there and eating, having a meal, and just...
Right.
It was great.
So to wrap this up, you've done so many different things. Could you summarize like the top two or three things you've learned along the way? Because you've given me advice for 15 years, and it usually...
Well, my usual one is CPH.
What's that?
Consistent, persistent, and honorable. You do that, in my opinion, you'll always succeed. Don't cheat, don't lie, don't do whatever, do whatever's right.
Right.
And that you'll be successful.
I think I follow that as well. Yeah. And I
you do. That's why I like you. I mean, that's why we get along because, yeah.
It's also the easiest thing to do. It takes a lot of energy to think of ways of cheating.
But how many people do that?
Not a lot.
That's the whole point is how many people spend so much energy trying to figure out ways around that kind of game.
Work around.
But it's, if you're that way, you never, nothing you have to worry about. There's no guilt. There's nothing. You don't feel bad because, you know,
It's the thing I think we mentioned earlier. Like your dad, you just heads down, work hard consistently.
Yeah.
You don't do wrong by anybody and you succeed.
Yeah. You know, I mean, you've persisted through some jobs, but you said, I'm going to persist because I want to have a year of this and I want to do that. Experience. And that's took a lot of guts to do that. But some of the things you went through in life.
Yeah. Well, next time you can interview me. I can tell some of those stories. Okay. I have a 2-year-old banging on the door for us.
Okay. So we got to go.
All right. Thank you, Henry.
Thanks.